We are very pleased indeed today to be able to host this discussion of Pakistan's economic and social challenges. Many of you know us for our in-depth work on security and political issues in Pakistan, and we are happy to be able to put a number of the economic and social issues on the table as well in this discussion. We have an excellent panel here to lead the discussion. Our speaker is Jan van de Mortel, who is a senior advisor on policy at UNICEF. Jan was the UN resident humanitarian coordinator and the UNDP resident representative to Pakistan for the period 2005 through 2007. And so we are fortunate to be able to benefit from his very recent experience and observations in Pakistan. Before his posting there, he was director of the poverty group at UNDP in New York, and before that, chief of social policy and economic analysis at UNICEF. Earlier in his career, he served with UNDP as senior economist for Malawi, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. His work has focused on equity and effectiveness of social and economic policy, of public finance, and labor markets. Our speaker will be followed by two discussants who each bring very deep knowledge based on their work and experience in Pakistan. We will hear first from Ambassador Teresita Schaefer, who is the director of the South Asia Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She joined CSIS after a 30-year career in the U.S. Foreign Service, where her work focused on international economic issues and South Asia, including service as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for South Asia and U.S. Ambassador to Sri Lanka. We will then hear from Frederick Garr, who is a visiting scholar with the Carnegie Endowment. Previously, he served in the French embassies in Pakistan and New Delhi as director of the Center for Social Sciences and Humanities for the French government. Frederick has written extensively on security issues, Islamist movements, and sectarian conflict in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So Jan will speak for about 20 minutes, and then we'll get comments from our discussants for about 10 minutes each and have ample time for a good discussion with you. Jan.
Thank you, Sandra, and thanks for coming to this presentation. I'm an economist by training, and I will deal with economic and social developments in Pakistan as I see it. So I left at the end of last year in December, so just 5 months ago. And then we can also get into some issues of governance, democracy, and maybe security issues, but we'll see how the discussion develops. And I have a few slides to help me through the presentation here. And let me start with stating the result of a long discussion between the scientists and the philosopher. And after many hours of discussion, they agreed that when you make a presentation, you cannot be clear and accurate at the same time. Either you are clear and you're not so accurate, or vice versa. The tragedy, of course, is that too many of the speakers are neither clear nor accurate in reality. So my aim is for clarity, and I don't put a claim on accuracy, because the topic that we are discussing, Pakistan, does not lend itself for any degree of accuracy. It has too many faces. It has the face of the angry fundamentalist, but it has also many other faces, like the three girls here on the first slide, and it has the face of empowered women whom we worked with in Lahore, who get microcredit a la Grameen Bank, and it has the face of nuclear scientists selling their technology to the highest bidder, and it goes on and on and on. So it's quite a complex country, and it is a country that has, of course, been in the news recently. These are just two cover stories taken of late last year and early this year, which place Pakistan as the most dangerous country in the world. And we can discuss whether there is validity in those statements. When you look at the kind of aggregate indicator for social and economic development of a country, the Human Development Index, HDI, is a useful one. It captures both material development, per capita income, life expectancy, and education. And you can see from this trend here, the past 30 years, Pakistan is the second from the bottom, the yellow line, that it has made progress, steady progress, more so than the bottom one, which is Niger, which is at the bottom of the HDI list, perhaps a bit less than Indonesia, which is the blue line and just above it. But one cannot say that Pakistan has not seen socioeconomic progress and development in recent years. Once we get clearer to a few of the key indicators of the MDG set, is the poverty. The first target of the Millennium Development Goals is to cut poverty by half. And here the trend of the data shows this funny inverted U-trend, where poverty increased in the 90s from 26% to 34%, and then decreased in the first half of this current decade from 34% to 24%. This is a steep drop of 10 percentage points in just 5 to 6 years. We checked the data. The data is okay. You can compare those indicators. So big progress. When I was there, the government, of course, made a big deal out of that statistic, that there was a 10 percentage drop in poverty rate. But when you look it into a more historical perspective, Pakistan basically was back in 2005, where it started off in 1990. So little or no progress in 15 years. We look at under 5 mortality rate, another key social indicator. This is the likelihood of a child dying before his or her 5th birthday. And here a steady decline from 140 deaths per 1,000 live births in 1990 to 105 in 2000, but then a slowdown to 100 in 2005. So we are not on track for the dotted line for the target to be reached of a cut by 2/3 by the year 2015. But when you compare Pakistan with other countries, Pakistan is showing an average performance. This is the data we have at UNICEF of under 5 mortality rate for 190 countries, the trends between 1990 and 2006. And so we plot the 1990 on the horizontal axis, the 2006 on the vertical axis, and then each country gets a blip there in the scatter diagram, and the countries that are below the black line are performing above average. The ones are above the line are seeing less than average progress. And what do we see? The red dot somewhere there in the middle is Pakistan smack on the line. So Pakistan is kind of doing average progress in under 5 mortality. It's not a high performer, certainly not, but it's not a lousy performer either. We have also data on under 5 mortality by quintile, which means within the country, how do the different population groups benefit from social progress? And the quintiles are 1/5 of the population, the bottom, the second, the middle quintile, up to the top quintile. You can see the colors go from yellow for the poorest to red for the richest, and we have data for 3 countries here. And again, Pakistan seems to show an average performance. Bangladesh, in the middle, shows a relatively egalitarian distribution of the social indicator among the poor and the rich. It's the gradient is not very steep. India, which is to the right of the screen, is showing a very steep gradient, where the poor have a much higher likelihood of dying before 5th birthday than a child born in a rich family. You can see that the red bar is at 40 for India. The yellow bar is at 140. So this is a huge gap between. Pakistan is kind of in between again. It's not an egalitarian picture that it depicts like Bangladesh, but it seems to be less unequal in terms of this health indicator than India. Where things really get worrisome for Pakistan is on education. We see a very lousy level and lousy trends in terms of education. Here, the key indicator is the net primary enrollment ratio, which is the percentage of children enrolled in primary school, going from 46% in 1990 to 42%, actually declining in the 1990s, and then picking up since 2000 to 52% only, which is way below the level for its status of economic development. The global aim is for having 100% enrollment ratio by the year 2015. It's very clear that this is way out of reach for Pakistan. And this is tragic because education, as we all know, not only has an intrinsic value, it very much has an instrumental value to reaching other goals in terms of health, in terms of environmental protection, in terms of economic development, etc. So this is one of the characteristics. And why is it that Pakistan is doing relatively poorly on education? This diagram is taken from a report from the Asian Development Bank that was published last year. And these bars show the proportion of girls who actually attend primary school between the ages of 6 to 10 for 12 countries. Pakistan is in the lower left side. This is girls' attendance of school. And so you can clearly see that Pakistan's distribution is an outlier. Most of the other countries have not only higher levels of girls' enrollment by quintile, again, by wealth group, between the poor, the middle class, and the rich. It is much lower in Pakistan, and the inequality is much, much deeper. You can see that when you look at the bottom quintile, less than 20% of the girls in the bottom quintile in the country were actually attending primary school. And this pattern is very different. And these data, of course, are a bit dated, but all the evidence that we have shows that this picture hasn't changed much. It is the gender gap in many of the social indicators that are pulling Pakistan down below the level where it should be. Pakistan conducted a demographic and health survey in 2006-2007. It's a huge sample size. It's 100,000 families, which is a pretty large size for any survey. And we have preliminary data available, and they show the following points, that almost one in every 10 children die before their fifth birthday, and there hasn't been much change in the last 15 years. 39% of the deliveries of babies are conducted by skilled health professionals. 39% is lousy. It is over 50% in sub-Saharan Africa. It is less than 40% in Pakistan today. The supplementation of breast milk starts way too early in Pakistan. Almost half the children get supplementary feeding before they are 2 months old, which, given the conditions of hygiene and safe water, is very often deadly for the children. So we have a major nutritional practice that is unhealthy and unsustainable. We have immunization. In 2006, 47% of the children were fully immunized in Pakistan, which was down from 53% in 2001. So we see a regression in the last 6-7 years. And again, it is way below the level that we should be seeing for an economy and a society like Pakistan. In sub-Saharan Africa, again, it is over 60% for fully immunization for the children. When they asked the women who are married whether they have heard about AIDS, only 44% of the women say, yes, we have heard about it. Similar surveys being conducted in African countries all show that over 90% and very often now 100% of the married women have heard about AIDS. Whether they know about it is something else, but at least they have heard about it. They're only 44% have heard about it. Again, it clearly shows that there are serious taboos in society that are related to sexuality and reproductive health that pose major challenges. The contraceptive prevalence rate has plateaued at only 30%. For the past 10, 15 years, all the surveys conducted show that it's not going up, it's staying put there. And this includes all forms of contraceptive prevalence. And therefore, the total fertility rate remains high, much higher than in the other countries in South Asia. We still have a total fertility rate of 4.1, which means that on average, every woman will have 4.1 babies on average in her reproductive lifetime, which is pretty high, much higher than in India for sure. And when you go to Pakistan, you will very often hear this item being seen as a positive thing, because they call it over there the population dividend, because there's going to be a surge in the youth population joining the labor market. And this, according to some analysts and many of the government people, is going to provide a boost for the economy for the years and the decades to come. Of course, that will depend on what kind of quality education those people are going to receive when they join the labor market. Still staying with the preliminary results of the demographic and health survey, three key indicators here: the deliveries of babies with health professionals, the children who are fully vaccinated, and the married women who have heard about AIDS, split up by quintile, by wealth groups. The same thing as we saw before. Not by quintiles, but by level of education, maternal education, excuse me. And you can see that, again, we see a very positive correlation between education and the level of welfare of the family and of the children. And two striking bars that I want to highlight here is the first red one and the third red one, where you see that less than 30% of the babies born to mothers without any formal education. And there are many like that in Pakistan. We know the statistics. There are many mothers who have no formal education. Less than 30% of those births are not attended by any skilled health worker. And less than 30% of those women have ever heard of HIV and AIDS, which of course put them at extra risk of infections. And you can see that the gradients between those level of educations are very steep indeed, especially for the first indicator and for the third indicator. Now, the question I want to ask here is, will Pakistan be the next Asian tiger, or will it be the next failed state? Goldman Sachs in Wall Street has come up with a concept called the BRIC, which is the acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the four big countries outside the OECD bloc that are pulling the world economy. And since then, beyond the BRIC, they have developed the notion of the next 11, which means that beside the BRIC countries, beside Brazil, Russia, India, and China, there are the next 11, another 11 countries that are going to pull the world economy forward in the coming decades. And Pakistan is part of the next 11. And of course, they were very proud in the past 2 years to have been included. But the club is not a highly selective club. Nigeria is part of the next 11. Indonesia is, of course, Bangladesh is part of the next 11. So there are many, many members of that club. But Pakistan is unlikely to be the next Asian tiger, because Pakistan is hitting very serious economic turbulence. It has unsustainable deficits, not only in terms of trade and in terms of the fiscal budget, the government structure, but also in terms of energy and in water, especially energy. The supply of energy has not kept pace with the level of economic activities that have taken place in the country over the past several years. I remind you that Pakistan has been among the high boom economies in the last 4 to 5 years, seeing economic growth rates just like, not as China, but similar to those in India, economic growth of 7 to 8% per annum. But supply of energy has faltered big time, mostly because of political reasons. We can come back to that in the discussion. But there are definitely huge unsustainable deficits. The trade deficit is mind-boggling. Its exports have by no way been able to keep pace with the surging import demand. There has been an historic underinvestment in basic services in Pakistan, and this is not only of any particular government. This truly has been for the past 60 years of the country. There has been, unlike Sri Lanka, there has been constant underinvestment. Two indicators. Pakistan spends less than 2% of its income on education, and it spends 0.7% of its income on health. So this is hardly 2.5% combined. Any country that has seen development, like others, have spent between 7 to 8% of their income on those two services. Pakistan is barely spending 2.5% on it. And again, this is something that has been existing in the country for decades. There has been, as I mentioned, a recent spurt in economic activities, growth rates of 7 to 8%, but that is ending. The new government has just revised its economic forecast to about 5%, which is kind of the traditional level of growth that we saw in the 90s, between 4 and 5%. And the growth spurts of the recent years have very much led to a series of bubbles, most of all in real estate, in Islamabad in particular. The Karachi Stock Exchange, KSE, has been of the fastest growing stock exchanges in the world. At one, I think in 2006 or 2007, it was the fastest growing in the world even, but it has been growing very fast. And there has been an enormous bubble in terms of selected consumer goods, most particular in small personal cars that are assembled in the country now, and in the cell phone technology, information technology. But those bubbles are starting to burst. The sale of personal vehicles is down 10% compared to last year, and the steam is certainly getting out of it. So very much, if you look at Pakistan's recent development, it hasn't changed very much from when Bill Easterly went there about a decade ago and coined that Pakistan's development was growth without development, because it has been growth, all right, but it has been growth that was not accompanied with any structural change in the economy or in the society. And it has been growth that has not really benefited the bottom, I would say, 60% of the population. The trickle-down has reached at most the middle class, who were able to buy some consumer goods like a Suzuki or a small Toyota and a cell phone, which is now becoming more difficult to access, but it has really not trickled down beyond that level. And it has left us with a very polarized society, and a polarization that takes many dimensions. First of all, gender-wise, men to women, Pakistan is one of the most polarized societies when it comes to the gender dimension. As I noted, the gaps between men and women for social indicators are very wide in Pakistan. Few other countries in the world have those. But it goes beyond the gender dimension. It's between the rich and the poor. It is between the ethnic groups. It is between the provinces. It is between the religious versus the secular. And it is between the military versus the civilian authorities. very polarized positions being taken. To come back here on one example, the unsustainable deficit in terms of energy is mostly due to the polarization between the provinces. As you know, Pakistan is a big producer of hydroelectric power taken from the Indus River. They have to build dams on that river and on some other rivers. They are unable to come to any position because, given that it is a federal state, the provinces do not trust one another, and they are bickering for decades and decades that I will not allow you to build a dam in your province because my province will not get the water anymore. And they are bickering, and in the meantime, the economy is running out of energy. So it's a very polarized society that doesn't augur well for the future. Not saying that it is going to be a failed state, but all those polarizations are certainly going to undermine the social cohesion that is needed to become a tiger of any sort. And my final slide is a bit more on the political side, whether Pakistan's future is one that will be democratic or that will be autocratic. Well, first, a few couple of statistics here on the sickly nature of democracy in Asia. In 2006, remember, we saw two military coups, one in Thailand, one in Fiji. And in 2007, we saw, of course, the state of emergency declared in Pakistan. But Pakistan was not the only one. The Bangladesh got a non-elected caretaker government that is still in office and trying to get through the muddle of democratization there. The Economics Intelligence Unit has recently come up with a ranking of all the countries according to their democratic index. They developed a comprehensive democratic index. And for the 27 countries in Asia, they classified 16 countries as flawed democracies, 10 countries as authoritarian, and only one country as a full democracy. And yes, you're right, the full democracy was not Pakistan. Pakistan falls in the category of the 10 authoritarian, albeit that it is just, it's the first one, it's just below the threshold between the flawed democracy and the authoritarian democracy. So it does better than Myanmar and North Korea, a lot better, but that's the picture. And once you have been in Pakistan for 3 years, like I have been, it's the issue about democratization is not only an issue whether the military or the civilians should be running the place. The history of the 90s have shown us very clearly that it is also the democratic practice among the existing political parties that is inadequate. Very often when they come into office, they misuse their authority, and that leads to ever-increasing degrees of abuse, either to cover up past mistakes or to enhance their privileges. And dynastic parties are very much a symptom of that. And I'm afraid that Pakistan falls into this category of having dynastic political parties that do not have the best of democratic practice within their political parties. We have two big parties where the leader of the political parties were kind of self-appointed for life of a political party that claimed to be democratic. So there are really major deficiencies within the democratic parties as such. This is beyond the issue of military involvement in politics. So I think it is safe to say that democracy in the country will continue to wobble. As the Yale professor called it, it is the science of muddling through. That will be the future of the country. I want here to underscore a few positive developments in terms of political developments. First of all, the number of women participating in the political process has increased tremendously because the previous government has put a quota on it that between a quarter and a third of all the positions should be open for women. And we had good progress in terms of running the women's political schools, because these were many illiterate women who all of a sudden were thrown into local councils or provincial councils, didn't have much of an idea of how to run a meeting, how to read a budget, and these are all developments that take place. Press freedom has definitely improved, especially the written press is relatively open. There was, of course, restrictions put on them during the emergency period late last year, but even then, the press was relatively open. And for the first time in Pakistan's 60-year development, we have seen last year one government ending its full term for the first time in 60 years. When the government completed, stepped aside, it was the first time ever that the government had actually completed its term in 60 years. So these are all measures. Yes, it is muddling through. It's certainly not a full democracy, but it will continue to do that. And the final point is that, yes, we need to leave space for a country like Pakistan and any other country to make it its own way, to have its own democratic development process, its own homegrown process. And there, speaking in the city we are in, we have to really understand that too much pressure can easily become counterproductive, that as a reaction to perceived external interference in domestic affairs can easily undermine the position of the reform-minded people within the country. And I believe I have seen some of that in terms of pushing on the security agenda and on the political agenda, that if we push it too hard and too openly, it very often ends up fueling the cause of the extremists and undermining the positions of the moderates in that society. And that's my last point of wisdom I want to put on the table before we get into that debate, that truly we need to have that political space to let the country develop its democratic process in its own way. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jan. You set yourself the goal at the beginning of trying to give a clear picture, if not accurate, of a very multifaceted, complex society. And I think that the wide array of indicators that you put in front of us really does help to give us some sense of that complexity in real time, very current information. Now we'll hear from Ambassador Schaefer for her comments.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to participate in this gathering. Jan said that he could either be clear or accurate, but not both. That is, in a literal sense, true, but I think you came pretty close to meshing both of them. I would like to make three basic points. One is to talk a bit about the reason for all of these depressing graphs about economic and social developments. Two, I'd like to say a few words about the politics of economics in Pakistan. And then finally, I would like to come back to Jan's final point about democracy and political space, because I think that really is a critical question at this moment. Looking through this rich array of graphs, which were portrayed in a manner that actually gives you a sense that you know what you're looking at, you see in graphic form the consequences of something that has troubled me for a long time. I served as a diplomat in Pakistan about 35 years ago during Zulfikar Ali Bhutto's time, and have off and on followed it ever since. During the, particularly during the early Musharraf years after Shaukat Aziz became finance minister, We kept hearing what we thought was a wonderful economic story. There were two things that were missing, and I think what you've just seen is the consequences of that. One was that there was very little investment in new productive capacity. Now, I don't have in my head the same kind of wonderful statistics, but if you go to the Pakistan Finance Ministry website, you will find them. I'm not talking about investment in the stock market. I'm talking about holes in the ground, factories, and jobs. The other is investment in people. Now, that graph about the inverted U for poverty rates is fascinating, and I need to think about that a bit more. But basically, all of the other depictions of bad social indicators are a reflection of the failure of Pakistan to invest in its people. And the responsibility for this goes back way before Musharraf even thought about becoming chief executive of Pakistan. This is a country which, certainly going back as far as Zulfikar Ali Bhutto and to some extent even before that, focused its investment on other things and didn't do much on health and didn't do much on education, with devastating consequences for a lot of people. When the U.S. resumed its aid programs after 9/11, there were a lot of well-intended words about how education was going to be a focus. Unfortunately, most of the aid was given in the form of cash or its functional equivalent. The degree to which the U.S. was investing in health and education, it was all basically done by somebody giving us a piece of paper at the end of the year saying, we've put your money into health and education. But the percentage of their economy that was invested in these sectors didn't move. And the moral of the story is it doesn't count unless you're getting a net increase in resources. Second, the politics of economics. This last election campaign was very interesting because after all this talk about improved economic situation, and in some respects it actually did improve during the Musharraf years, one can debate how much of this was catch-up for a terrible decade before and how much of it was real improvement, but there were some meaningful changes. But all of a sudden, the economy came back during the election in the form of high food prices and electricity shortages, and those have only gotten worse since. The systemic problem in Pakistan is primarily a failure to invest in people and in jobs, but the things that bring people out into the streets, that get them in their gut, are high food prices, unavailability of food, unavailability of electric power. So that he who would govern Pakistan has to be able to satisfy both of those requirements. Then you come to the politics of politics, or the issues relating to democracy in Pakistan. I lived in Pakistan when there was an elected government headed by an absolutely extraordinary politician who, however, had absolutely no patience with institutions and systematically centralized power and destroyed institutions for as long as he remained in power. Sorry, I thought I'd already hit that. Having an elected government does not ensure that it will govern democratically. And we saw that illustrated again during the 1990s when you had four governments, alternating governments by two people, which won elections that were kind of okay, but which then governed in a winner-take-all fashion. Now, it's easy to sit here in Washington and pass judgment. That actually doesn't get you very far. You now have an election which has taken place, and I was in Pakistan right after the election and found both a great sense of excitement among people who never thought that they would actually be able to express their opposition to the present management and who saw that they'd done it, but who were then terrified that the moment was going to slip away. I think there is a real danger that that would happen. One of the things that needs to happen is that the government, however imperfect it may be, has to actually have a chance to try governing. Another thing that needs to happen is the rebuilding of institutions. And the unfortunate thing about this is that much as outsiders might like to help, they can only be in a helping role. The actual work has to be done locally. But the phrase that Jan used at the end I thought was particularly apt, and that was political space. You have a government which is focusing about 97% of its attention, I don't know what the standard deviation is there, on staying together, sort of, and staying in power, but that has major problems to deal with. One is particularly conscious of this in Washington because the United States has become a political issue, and because the one other issue that the government has begun to deal with, namely the question of the internal insurgency, which has led to suicide bombings all over Pakistan, is one that I think Pakistanis recognize as being desperately dangerous for their own country. But on that issue, the government's only chance of really being able to follow through on a policy is for that policy not to appear to have been made either by Musharraf or in Washington. One of my frustrations is that I think the U.S. government has been rather slow to figure this out. And both its continuing embrace of Musharraf and its efforts to embrace the new government have wound up constricting that government's political space. I think some of the same arguments apply on the economic side, although there the issue of the U.S. being part of the problem is not so prominent. It's really more a question of whether the government can find the political space to take decisions that will not, in the short term, be very popular. And with energy, with oil at upwards of $120 a barrel, I think you can be 100% sure that unpopular decisions are going to be necessary, because the consequence of popular energy prices is going to be no power. I don't have a nice, neat soundbite of a prognosis for you. I think that fundamentally the points Jan made were right on target. I think that this is a time for Pakistan's well-wishers to give the economic fundamentals a higher profile than they've had for the past 6 or 7 years. The good news is that you do have talent there, and that with a little luck, a little skill, and a lot of self-restraint on the part of both the Pakistan government and its friends, it might actually be possible to get there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Schaefer, and now Frederic.
Thank you, Sandra. Although after those two presentations, I really wonder whether I should thank you for being here, because there are two solutions. Either you just stop here and cry, or you start wondering what could be done. And the problem really is, I mean, I certainly agree with all the fundamental issues which have been underlined here. The lack of investment in human capital. And I think that demonstration would have been even stronger if you had shown what the other South Asian countries, even excluding India, has done, because even Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, despite their own difficulties, have fared much better than Pakistan when it comes to human development indicators. That's one aspect of it. But I also believe the lack of investment in infrastructure and so on and so forth. But I mean, lack of investment of infrastructure is also the result of policy and policies I've made any time and all the time by the people who are in place. So today we have a strong energy shortage, very right. But in the last 8 years, we haven't had a single power plant built. So yes, there was this major issue of the Karabakh Dam and a major issue between the provinces. But that was not the only thing, because we have a decision which haven't been made. And if you remember the last tenure of Prime Minister Sharif, for example, which by many accounts was a complete disaster in terms of the economics of the country, India and Pakistan were negotiating about the sale of electricity. It doesn't mean that it would have taken place for obvious political reasons, but I mean, those discussions were there. Where are we today? I mean, well, we could say in a bit cynical way that the two countries are getting closer to each other because Lahore is experiencing the same kind of electricity shortage and Delhi has been for years. So much for the rapprochement between the two countries. I would like to come back also on the idea of the polarization of the society. Because, I mean, this polarization against is not even questionable. But I think that some of it should be nuanced, some of it should be emphasized. And the one which should be emphasized is the social polarization. Not just, you know, it's not just the fact that people are rich, people are poor. It's just the fact that, irrespective of who is in power, military, civilian, or whatever, the gap between, let's say, in any given party, the elite and the grassroots of the party, and the elite on both sides of the military-civilian divide is more important within the party socially than it is between the other elite. And that is probably the reason, for example, for the under-investment in things like education. Because where there you see quite a convergence of interest between the number of landlords, for example, the military to some extent, it would have to be nuanced, and the religious establishment for not promoting stronger, with more strength, the public education system, and so on and so forth. So, you know, yes, we are seeing the result of long-term underinvestment in everything, except that the long-term is to be corrected by measures taken at any point in time when you're in power. And those measures were not taken before. They were not taken during the last government. It remained to be seen whether they will be taken there. Now, some of those divides can also be reduced. We're talking of the ethnic divide. What is the ethnic divide, basically, except it is between Punjab and all the other provinces, and, of course, with the acute problem of Balochistan, which hasn't been solved, and the problem of the MQM, which has been totally instrumentalized, and not only by the military, by the way, for political reason. There, I think that a degree of responsibility would definitely help, and this is not something which is irreversible. We tend to see Pakistan as a country with no real sense of unity, nationalism without a nation. It was the title of a book by Christophe Jaffrelot. We tend to forget that all those provinces live together in British India, for example. So there is a tradition of cohesiveness, whether we like it or not. Some provinces wanted to secede at the time of independence, but yet, I mean, this is something which is still there and which has been exacerbated by recent policies. I mean, there had been a period in the past where the polarization was perhaps worse. I mean, it led to the partition of Pakistan, led to the creation of Bangladesh in the 70s. We had a major problem in Balochistan in the 70s. Yet, we were in the past in a slow, painful integration process. This had been reversed. This can be reversed the other way as well. If you look at a lot of demand of the social nationalists not so long ago, what they were asking for, and that would apply for the MQM just as well, was
could be assimilated, what we could call nationalism or integration. You ask for your autonomy or you ask for independence in order to be better integrated and get a better deal within the federation. So, you know, this coin has two sides. If we look at the religious divide, yes, there is a religious divide, of course. But at the same time, what the last election have shown, that, you know, this is not the primary divide, that people vote for or against political party irrespective of their religious beliefs. So this is something which I think should be considered encouraging. Of course, we do have sectarian violence. We do have Shia opposing Sunni and vice versa and so on and so forth. But this too has been instrumentalized. I mean, let me be clear here. Every society, wherever it is, does generate its own extremism. But if this extremism is encouraged for domestic political purposes, then of course it becomes worse. But this then is the result of a policy which can be reversed. I'm not saying that it's going to produce results overnight, definitely not. But I mean, there are reasons to be not necessarily optimistic, but perhaps not as pessimistic as what can think. Well, and the military versus civilian divide, well, that has been the major issue of Pakistan for years. Will it be reversed? It is in a way being reversed. Not totally, not in a decisive manner, but the situation is not what it used to be, and because of both sides. There is a huge difference, for example, of what we've seen in the 90s with all the consequences that we saw before, when basically what we did call democracy was at best delegated power from the military and the present situation. Well, the military themselves was seriously under pressure, where they have proved that they were unable to guarantee security of the country, which was the basis for the legitimacy. And where at the same time, the civilians were clearly criticizing them, rejecting them, and a deliberate decision of the military to stay, for example, out of the election, or relatively out of the election, but a more assertive civilian at the same time. So yes, we're not in the situation which is glorious. We're in a situation where each and every actor is looking for his position in something which is, I believe, a new setting. So when you use the expression muddling through, I think this is exactly the way I see Pakistan in the next 5 to 10 years, with all the usual suspect being there and yet not at the same time, with other signs which could be considered encouraging, although it remains to be seen how it will evolve, such as the fact, for example, that out of 343 MNA, which who were recently elected, 192 were never elected before. Is it the beginning of grassroots is perhaps not the term, but I mean, of a movement which will lead to a complete change of the political class? I'm not sure. Are we going in that direction? Yes. I mean, remember what is being called the silent revolution on the other side of the border, on the east, and you have perhaps the beginning of a process which goes in that direction. Then after that, it will be up to the government, whatever they are, to decide where they want to go and so on and so forth. And I'll stop there.
Thank you, Frederic. And now we'd like to open to your comments and your questions. I know we have a lot of expertise in the audience as well, so please feel free to speak.
Military and civilian problem that you see it improving somewhat, but we also, it was noted that the economy and the development is necessary in order for Pakistan to progress, but it is my understanding that the military has a huge hold over the economy with their assets. So do you see them increasing and progressing in that way by pulling out from there, because it seems like that would need to happen in order for the developments that you stated to occur?
Well, I'm not sure that we can really equate the two questions. First of all, one has to wonder whether the fact that the military have huge... First of all, whatever part the military take in the economy, is not necessarily doesn't necessarily mean the same thing everywhere. It's not the same thing, for example, to appropriate the land, redistribute it between your proxies and so on, and the fact that you run a company here and there. Because in one case, you're just part of the normal economy, except that the benefits go to somebody who is or has been a military, and in the other case, this is something which is close to extortion or is extortion. So those two things are not comparable to start with. B, the fact that the military as a strong asset in the economy is not per se, again, an impediment to development. It is certainly an impediment to better civilian-military relations because it does guarantee a measure of autonomy, but not everything can be done at once, if anything is done at all. But I think that since Indonesia was mentioned there, Indonesia is a good example of what could eventually be Pakistan in a few years. Well, a few years ago in Indonesia, in the New Order regime, you had the military just controlling absolutely everything in something which was to some extent close to a totalitarian system. They have kept their asset to a large extent. I mean, the territorial structure, which was the basis of their power in Indonesia, is still very much there. And there, then their political power is no longer what it used to be. And it's not an excuse for the lack of development of the country. So I see perhaps Pakistan going, well, just an hypothesis, of course, but I see a possibility that Pakistan may go in that direction at some stage. But I wouldn't say that this is, I mean, the fact that all the substantial part of the economy is an absolute impediment to development.
There's one other thing that's worth saying. The military, whatever else you may say about them, actually has invested in its people. The standard, the educational standard requirement for enlistment in the Army, I'm not talking about being an officer, is 10 years of schooling and matriculation. This is an extraordinarily high standard. As a result, I suspect that there are virtually no military-dependent children who remain illiterate. They run their own school system. In a well-ordered universe, the way they do that actually might have some lessons for how people might want to do it on the outside, but that's kind of a tough lesson to transfer.
Ken Dillon, Sciencia Press. If one reads the accounts of environmental problems in Pakistan, the situation seems pretty desperate. Starting with deforestation, flooding, loss of topsoil, salinization of the land, all kinds of pollution, and so on. Two questions about it. First of all, is this an accurate portrayal of how bad the situation is? And secondly, how does that fit into the overall social, economic, and political prospects of Pakistan?
Yes, the environmental challenge is huge. Pakistan is blessed with many ecosystems on its soil, but they're all very much under threat by population growth and by rapid economic development. And the reports are true. It is alarming. I think the government is conscious of it. GEF, the Global Environmental Fund, is investing quite a huge share of its portfolio in the country. Whether we will be able to turn it around is another question, because most of the erosion is at the margins. It's not yet affecting the main agricultural lands where most of it is grown, the Punjab. It's mostly in the north, in NWFP, and of course in Balochistan, where you will have population movements, but since the density there is less, it will probably not have a big impact politically or socially in the years to come. But if they don't address it, and if the erosion and the salinity continues to creep into the Punjab, which is becoming a huge problem. The salt, that is the salt concentration of the irrigated soil, is becoming a problem, then the country is going to face a tough point of time.
If I may just add a word, ironically, that should be an element to solve the overall water issue, for example. Pulp salinization problem in Punjab, for example, is not due to lack of water. It's just due to an excessive irrigation. So when you discuss after that the share of water between the province, that should be an incentive, at least there are others, of course, to go in the right direction.
Thank you. The question is basically to the entire panel. What about the Indophobic nature of the Pakistani society?
Please identify yourself.
I'm Rajesh Kadian. I've done some writing on the subcontinent. How important is the Indophobic nature of the Pakistani society and its commitment to the Kashmir question in leading to this reduction in all these parameters that you so depressingly pointed out to us? Thank you.
I agree that that has historically been a problem. I don't actually see that as terribly important as a factor in the social and economic development we've been talking about. I think this, what we've been talking about, has a lot more to do with social relationships within Pakistan, with the land tenure patterns, and with the patterns of investment. You could have a frightfully virtuous India policy and still have the same fundamental economic problems.
If I may add something on that, I mean, I think that this characterization of the Indophobic nature of the Pakistani society is largely exaggerated. Over the past 5 years, every time we went to Pakistan, every time there were Indians visited, they were greeted there, not by the official who invited them, but in the markets, where they got systematic discounts. So whoever is Indian there, they're getting good business to do by just going to Pakistan. But I would like to come back for a minute on the Kashmir question. I mean, no one has ever asked whether there was a real constituency for the Kashmir question in Pakistan. And I would certainly argue that there is a sympathy for the cause overall. But I would also argue that the constituency for the cause itself, the real support for the cause, is extremely limited. It's limited to places where there is a strong Kashmir refugee community. So you will find them in Lahore. You will find them in some places of central Punjab. You will find them in some places of the NWFP. But overall, it would be largely exaggerated to say that there is a great, great, great support for whatever is done over there.
I think this is one of the areas where there is positive developments. The earthquake helped there. Actually, the line of control, we had 5 points opened on the line of control for some minor influx for relief items. It was more symbolic than of logistical importance, but it was there. And also, it cuts both ways. It's not only on one side. It is on both sides. I have been summoned 3-4 times to the office of the Indian High Commissioner in Islamabad, when we had 40-plus helicopters flying around from the UN. And, of course, these pilots, mostly from the Ukraine, didn't bother too much about the line of control. And then he would always hand me a stack of violations of Indian airspace, and he would batter me. So it definitely goes on both sides. If it comes to the population, indeed, as Frederick said, when there is a cricket match, the taxi drivers do not charge the Indians when they come. They take them for free to the stadium to watch the cricket match. And they are befriended very much. It's very much an issue that will fade away, because I believe if in both sides the foreign ministries would put the next generation in charge, those who are 45 and less in age, I think this thing would see a much faster solution than by keeping it in the hands of the 60-plussers, as is the case at least on the Pakistani side, as I have seen.
My name is Chari. I work in the Institute of Peace and Conflict Studies in New Delhi. And my question was to our speaker. I must congratulate you, sir, on your slides and the way that you presented your case. But I have a methodological problem with the manner in which these statistics were presented. What you use is the budgetary angle. You point out that so much of money has been allocated for education, or so much of money is allocated for public health. And you feel that depending on the amount of money and what is this relationship to the GDP and so on, I mean, this is a very traditional way of dealing with the issue. But what is the effectiveness of that expenditure? What I mean to say is that you may be spending not 2 or 3% of the GDP on education. But if you have schools without teachers, and those teachers in those schools don't teach, it's a waste of expenditure. And similarly, as far as public health is concerned, you may have sort of, you know, rural dispensaries, public health centers, and so on and so forth. But if you don't have doctors, and if the doctors don't have medicines, and they don't have the facilities, then its point is useless. What I'm trying to say is that governance issue, as far as social economic expenditures and their control and the supervision is concerned, is to my mind equally, if not more important than the amount of money that you allocate. I wonder what your thoughts are.
I think you're making a valid point. I think the story for Pakistan is to spend more and to spend better on social services. The level is important because it would take an inordinate level of efficiency in any country with the amounts that the country is spending on health and education to have a reasonable result. If you spend only 2.5% of your income on those two sectors, you need an extremely high, almost a perfect system. And we know the system is not perfect, so we have to spend more, we have to spend better. The devolution process is helping. Of course, I know that what they call devolution under Musharraf is basically decentralization to the district level or to the local level. I know every military regime in Pakistan has done a decentralization, and in other countries they do it as well. I think it's a substitute of political legitimacy that they do that. But it brings a positive side in terms of setting up reporting mechanisms at the local level to see where the monies actually end up. There is one thing in terms of budgeting. There is another thing in terms of how much actually of the money that is budgeted gets to the schools in the districts, whether the teachers are paid, whether the teachers are present. And that system is gradually being put in place. And hopefully it will generate a stricter demand on the communities to claim from their politicians and to claim from the provincial and the federal governments to live up to their promises. But you cannot say that Pakistan is spending enough but is not spending wisely. No, it has to spend more as well. And very often, insufficiencies lead to inefficiencies in those sectors. So as we spend more, we will be able to spend a bit better in the future.
Thank you. Chris DeAngelis from the U.S. Trade Representative's Office. I was out in Pakistan around the same time as you, Mr. DeVoro. And when I was wondering, the whole time I was there was, and Ambassador Schaefer alluded to it, there was this big question that no one seemed to really want to address, and it's land reform. I'm wondering what role there is for land reform, you know, particularly over the longer term, to resolving some of these problems.
Yes, Pakistan has tried it a couple of times, at least to my knowledge, to do land reform, including under the first Bhutto. It didn't go very far. If you look at the statistics, Pakistan has a very unequal land distribution. It classifies itself among the very unequal countries, and you must have been to Sindh and to other places where the latifundia are very visible and almost feudal systems still prevail. Honestly speaking, I don't think there is any political climate and leadership present today to tackle that hot potato. I don't think the political leadership and the political parties are too much in with the big landowners to expect that we are going to see a land distribution anytime soon. It is unlikely to happen. I don't justify it, but it's just a very realistic view of things. It should happen, but especially Punjab does a bit better. Punjab has a better land distribution, but in places like Sindh, I think land distribution is overdue, but it's unlikely to happen. At least that's my view of things.
No one has ever won an election with Pakistan without winning Punjab. The coalition that elected Zulfikar Ali Bhutto and that, with minor modifications, elected his daughter a couple of times involved Sindh outside the cities and the most feudal parts of Punjab. And that's the party that is not a Punjabi party per se.
I'm Arvind Weimer, I'm Middle East Institute. How important is the stabilization of the security environment in Afghanistan for economic growth expansion in Pakistan?
Critical, absolutely critical, because if Pakistan wants to maintain its current favorable rating with international investments, it will have to tackle the security issue. And it's very clear that the security issue comes from the border with Afghanistan. All the trends in terms of spread of fundamentalism, it all comes from the West. And it's gradually and surely spreading across into most of NWFP, and I've lived that myself. When I got there 3 years ago, most of Northwestern Frontier Province was open for business for us and for most NGOs and development workers. When I left December last year, apart from the enclave of Peshawar, all of NWFP was off limits for UN people and for other international operators, including the NGOs. And it's happening in the northern areas as well. It's all coming from the border areas, and that fundamentalism is spreading pretty much like a virus from the West and is cutting across. It is in Balochistan, and they will have to stop it, and it's a major issue. I know Pakistan gets blamed for the problems in Afghanistan. I've been a couple of times to Afghanistan. Many of the people I worked with in Islamabad were intimately involved with the work previously in Afghanistan. Things are not going good in Afghanistan, and are probably going to get worse before it gets better. And this is a very, very serious matter for Pakistan, because it will suffer from it, and the economic climate will be affected, because the business community will just run away from the country if it's going to start affecting the major hubs like Islamabad, Lahore, the Punjab, Karachi. It's going to be a problem, and the trend is very clear. You don't have to be a political scientist to know that it is not under control as we speak.
Jeff Lundstedt from American University and Middlebury College. The statistics you showed were basically national statistics, and you disaggregated them by wealth and by education, but not by region. We all know that Pakistan is regionally very differentiated. The real question is not whether it's differentiated, but are there any positive places? If you look at India, for instance, you find that Kerala, Tamil Nadu, some other places have made real positive progress. Not that, so is there any positive areas, not necessarily provincial, they could be sub-provincial, where real progress is being made, or is it simply differentiated disappointment?
If there is, it's northern Punjab, I think, apart from Lahore, is probably the area that is that has provided a good picture in terms of overall development. Education, especially girls' education, seems to be working there. The provincial authorities are committed. The resources are being invested. The private sector is very much into it. It's a good private-public partnership, as we call it. This seems to be working. So the northern part of the Punjab is probably the closest one gets to Kerala in India when you are in Pakistan. Can it be replicated? I do not think that the political constellation in the other provinces are ready for that. The next one, if any, will be NWFP. But Sindh and the Balochistan, I think, are caught up in their own political dynamics that I do not see them becoming really a development state, as we see in Kerala and as we saw in northern Punjab, perhaps. NWFP, yes, that's probably the next best one. But they will have to hurry up because that fundamentalism is starting to sneak in into the society very, very fast. I have spoken to American colleagues, ladies who told me they were working in Peshawar in the 80s and they bicycled to work in Peshawar. If you were to do that today as a foreign woman, you wouldn't go very far on your bicycle in these days. And they paint over when you see commercial boards for tea, and there is a woman in the picture, her face gets painted over immediately in those days in Peshawar. So it's really becoming a very, very different place as it used to be just 10 years ago.
Central. Two trade questions. One is, I mean, geography matters, so, you know, trade with India would make a big difference, I suspect. And so do you see any prospects for any breakthroughs on that? And the second one is the double-edged sword of the big capital inflows and remittances that have occurred since 2001, which on the one hand is creating part of the growth and a little bit of a, you know, sort of bubbling of small-scale, you know, small-shop, middle-class life. On the other hand, is dampening down prospects for the textile industry and more or less killing off any development of any other export industries. So do you see any, how do you see the balance between those things? You called the trade deficit unsustainable, but it's actually a capital inflow that has made the trade deficit, in my opinion.
I think on the India-Pakistani economic diplomacy, I think that is taking place. One sector where that is becoming very visible is in the information technology. India being a country where the wages of the programmers is becoming high and not so competitive anymore, many of the Indian information technology firms are starting to subcontract their programming work to Pakistani programmers, where the salaries are still much lower and they are as good a programmer as one can get. So I think the economic diplomacy is taking place. Of course, the politicians will have to catch up and open the border and allow more than one train a day. Do you know that there is one locomotive, one train a day crossing the border, the railroad with Lahore every day, only one train, and if your wagon is not hooked on that one, you have to wait for the next one to come. So there is huge potential there, and I think the politicians, and I think this is more the generation that should be retiring pretty soon. Once they get out, I think this will happen definitely on both sides. On the remittances and foreign investments, it's good we got the foreign investments. I had to live through the consequences of the earthquake in Kashmir. If it hadn't been for the remittances, we would have had less of a successful relief operation because these people were able to survive thanks to the remittances they got from the diaspora, mostly in the US and in the UK. Whether this is going anywhere? No, because, and that's the tragedy of Pakistan, that we have had a good 10 years of relatively stable economic development, rapid growth, but you don't see really a structural change in the economy.
A very high percentage of Pakistan's economy and exports are concentrated in cotton in one form or another, either raw cotton or cotton products. The textile industry has been astonishingly dependent on really low-end stuff. When I was in Pakistan, we spent weeks and weeks negotiating quotas for bar mops, which is a form of glorified dish rag. And bar mops are still a big deal. So, you know, within these big generalizations, I would say this to illustrate the larger point that I think Jan made correctly. Trade with India is still very modest. The potential is certainly there. I agree that the bureaucrats are an obstacle. I can't help remembering a conversation I had with the Sri Lankan High Commissioner in Delhi just after Sri Lanka and India had signed a free trade agreement. It was a free trade agreement that was going to apply initially to 3,000 products. The two leaders rammed it through over the heads of their commerce officials, who then initially saw to it that the first 3,000 products on the lists were products that neither country traded. It took several years before they got anything real on the list, following which it actually became quite effective. But don't underestimate the problem of the politicians as an obstacle. There are two economists, one of whom is working now at the World Bank, who put together really a very sensible project for opening trade with India. They focused on what were the products that might actually be successful. They looked at it from both sides' point of view, trying to put together a win-win agreement. This was early in Benazir Bhutto's first time, I think, as prime minister. She was strong politically. She really wanted to move it. And then she chickened out because she was afraid of backlash from those who might have to compete with the new imports, even though there were imports that looked like they would be, exports that would look like they would be a good bet. Chris, there in the back of the room, will understand perfectly. You have, as a nation, an opportunity to make money in your export sector, but it's somebody else that's going to pay the price with import competition.
Well, clearly one of the problems for Pakistan is to reinform its export capabilities. And there is a huge sector which is totally underexploited, which is agriculture. I mean, we have had a few, we have a serious problem with the food prices this year, but it's also due, beside the world trend, to heavy speculation on the wheat and other commodities. But I think a larger problem is in the fact, for example, that about 50% of all crops are lost every year, that Pakistan cannot compete in terms of conservation what it does. So it cannot export elsewhere. It cannot meet, for example, the European standards when Europe is its number one trading partners, and so on and so forth. Again, we're back to the same issue that was mentioned at the beginning, which is the lack of investment in productive infrastructure. And that's more important overall than whatever trade will be achieved with India in the short term. Not the least because I think it was implicit in everything which has been said before, because it's not just the bureaucrat, it's not just the politician, it's just everybody who is scared of being overflown by Indian product because they see a dynamism of the Indian economy that they cannot match. And therefore, everybody tends to be extremely defensive when it comes to that kind of issue. Politicians do behave the way they do simply because they do have a constituency which say, well, not too quickly, please.